Friday, June 17th, Dwayne Addison, part of our series of Native American spirituality. Today, our concern is humor is sacred. Welcome. I want to begin with, again, silence. This is indeed a part of worship in most traditions of spirituality. But this note, and then to take our moment of the sacred of silence, and we'll move into both the concerns of worship in a very general way, but then move on to that particular concern I want to lift up of humor as a necessary part of worship. This is from The Sacred. Again, the book that I mentioned is a collection of writings largely from Native American sources that are nationally oriented. One concept we have not discussed much was that of silence. Silence is also sacred. Just as the origin of language and the power to speak with plants and animals is a mysterious thing, learned and known by only a few people, and also the fact that the only way a person can learn the language of the wind and of the trees and of the streams is to be silent for a very long time. This makes silence an important part of the sacred language, of prayer and of song. Many traditions speak of this, but Native Americans as well. And that phrase that come back from Black Elk that he had learned is sort of the model form of the vision quest. Be attentive as you walk. There's a way, a new way of feeling, of seeing, and hearing. And then the messages will come to find your center. Let us be silent. Help us, Creator Spirit, to hear the winds and our fellow creatures, to hear each other, that we may find our way to you more clearly. Amen. Again, a few affirmations about worship as a whole, and then to zero in on the role of humor, and as we've done in the other sessions this week, after some attention to these affirmations, that I think represent a great deal of experience of thousands of years of many Native American traditions, although the illustrations will come from the Southwest or from the Plains area, to go on in terms of what we can learn as Christians about our own spirituality, our own worship, and this part, and the insights that are there. The two basic affirmations, and I want to explore each of them briefly. Worship, that is worship in the sense of ceremony, we're going to talk about the action, the liturgy, we might say, is central. Nearly every account of Native American spirituality dwells upon this. It is not only a matter of the inwardness, but it must be expressed corporately and publicly, visibly. And I want to explore that. One of the sources that that I refer to that talks about the Plains Indians, this statement, oversimplified, perhaps romantic, but it points to the truth. Indian life, it said, was one long, never-ending religious ceremony. It has seemed that way from the outside, and some of the historical accounts that the European Americans came in, and the trouble the Indians were always dancing when they should be working and taking care of the important matters and getting their livelihood. The powwows, even now today I hear that the trouble is anytime you have a powwow, you can't trust the Indians because it's more important that they travel off to do the powwow circuit. And it has a sort of modern variations to dance and to sing and to share is indeed one of the most important sorts of things. It may have taken other shapes and forms, but it is still very much alive. And I guess I would affirm that essentially that is a good thing. And the second affirmation that I want to lift up the most, humor is a necessary part of worship. And I add in parentheses, and of life. And I'll come to that, but the essential affirmation that I hear in the accounts and the interpretations of that is that we as human beings are weak and foolish. The central idea of the idea we would call sin. It is important to recognize that, and so the idea of humor comes to the very heart of worship. Again, this book, The Sacred, looking over the whole tradition of North American spirituality, identifies this as one of the six primary concepts or core themes that wherever you turn, you will find it liberally expressed. By the way, I got misidentified this morning, and you know, I'm Duane Addison and not Daryl, and Daryl. Daryl Nelson is my colleague from Sioux Falls who was here as the resident artist. And so we got it mixed up this morning, but that's fine. That first affirmation, worship. I learned a great deal on this from many sources, but particularly from an author. I mentioned her earlier this week, Ruth Underhill. I think she's still alive, the last account I heard. And I hear from her from Indian people because nearly all of her adult life she has lived among Indian people and very sensitive to the women's role in the societies, very attentive to spiritual concerns. And she listens and learns and shares. And one of her themes, one of her statements is, what we learn from Native American peoples is that ceremony is where it is at. To understand Native American life in its traditional form and indeed in its modern expressions is that which is sort of a, we would call liturgy, the public liturgy. She and others have commented, I've introduced it to my friends who deal with liturgy in the seminary and said we can learn a lot to instruct us. That's the theme, the area I wish to go to. That we of the West, and particularly Protestant Christians, have made our worship largely a matter of the ear and of the mind. We listen, and if we're Lutherans, we also get the voice in there, and so we have that sometimes our Calvinist brothers and sisters even lack that, you know, saying that. But it is that, but we are not much different. God comes by hearing, that is, by the ear. And we take that and put it into thoughts and ideas and reflection and an intellectual sense. A matter of sitting rather than of doing. And you turn to Native American things, both contemporary and the traditional. Very important to have the sight, the color, the visual thing, the sound, the smell, and most particularly the motion. Worship is very much a matter of doing and of sharing in a very public sort of way. My colleague in teaching Indian studies, I'm his junior colleague in a sense because he is the one who comes from Native American society and deeply has learned from this, Martin Brokenleg at Augustana College. Even before he came to Augustana, I used to have him come and visit my classes and talk about these things, and particularly the relationship of Native American religion to Christianity. Martin is a very devout Christian. He's become a Russian Orthodox, and he sees similarities himself with that. And his comment that he intrigued me at the time was that it is unlikely that the Native American Christian community will produce any great theologians, persons of the mind. But our contribution to the Christian faith, he says, will be those who do the liturgy, be in the area of worship, like the Eastern Orthodox, as indeed now pouring into the larger Christian community, thinks the great contribution is in that area. That has intrigued me because I suspect there's much truth to it. The elements of worship. Again and again, they're common to all cultures, but here we can learn from Native American communities. Much of it is concerned with centering. To find the center of yourself, because that also is where the center of the creation is as well. To learn here and to prepare that you are a part of all things, of all elements of the creation. We've talked about this because worship ties in with these other themes we've dealt with. Prayer is such an important part. Maybe that is obvious, but this is what I'm reminded in talking to Christian Native Americans on the reservations of South Dakota, that we've always been the people of prayer, that prayer in terms of a variety of ways is deeply a part of us. And saying that when Christian ministers, and particularly Episcopalians, come in from the outside, they should recognize that they're not teaching us about prayer, but they're to build upon those experiences and modes of prayer that we have. Most obvious in many Native American cultures, traditional and contemporary, prayer surrounds the pipe. It is the primary instrument of prayer. It is how you pray, and the prayer pipe is important because When you use the pipe and the ceremony and the symbolism and the colors that are with it and the motions, it is to include all creation. And human beings are the mediators. Very important role in worship, because it is their job to include and to center the rest of creation. And then in the pipe here, it is the fire which represents the spirit. And the voice of human beings, along with the presence of the spirit, brings it all together, and we pray in common. The element of thanksgiving is rich. If you consider the rituals and the liturgies and the songs, the most potent theme, the most common theme that runs through those is of giving thanks. Christians ought to recognize this, and many similarities to our psalms. But the other elements of petition, of the giving of blessing, and again, the theme that I'd underline, of reminding. A reminding who you are as creatures. And then the binding together. That worship is in essence, at least one of its great roles, of not only reminding us of this, but really bringing us together, that we are one. It is the role of human beings here in their acts of worship to bond that creation together. Those elements, perhaps more, are central again and again. And some of the characteristics, if we look at the worship forms as a whole in Native American community, it is very dramatic. Again, that is true in many cultures. You move, you share. Nobody is there as an observer. The children and the women, the young and the old, participate in the drama. So like the ancient Greek dramas grew out of the context of liturgy and worship, stories are dramatized. In the story of Black Elk, it represents, and again is the theme that comes through, when finally he has the courage to share his vision, his childhood visions, there the advice of the holy man is that we must perform them. They must be done in the presence of the people, that vision becomes the possession of the whole people, if it has to be meaning. Much to do with dance and with motion and with gesture. It is interesting that in the 1880s in the plains and perhaps other times at other places, very stringent efforts were put out by the U.S. government, sometimes at the encouragement of missionaries and of those who were there to civilize. The most important thing to do was to tap out dancing, not only the what they thought was a gruesome sun dance that was sort of bloody and pagan, but other forms of dancing, because the ethos of the times said that it was a foolish thing. It tied them back with the old ways, and dancing was very feared. One of the parts of the ghost dance sort of spread across the western United States in the late 1880s. The dance was associated with the war dance. The outsiders knew, they didn't understand, but the Indians danced, trouble was coming. You know, the natives are restless tonight. And so that ghost dance, at least in the form it took in the plains, was a largely Christian operation, a mixture of Advent Christianity and native concerns, but seemingly the universal interpretation of the white people around there that the Indians were prepared to attack in terms of violence. And so the dance has been feared and misunderstood. There's the role of music. And that's a whole subject in itself. I'm not a musician, but I can begin to appreciate that. How important the drum is. That's the chief instrument. And the symbolism of that. Almost every Native American culture that I've looked upon, the drum is there, and the drum becomes the symbol. If you visit Native Americans in the prisons, and there are many in my part of the country, one of the most important things they need is that they have the drum there to share, even if they're Christian, as well as a native of the traditional sorts of people. Other instruments, it varies, but various kinds of flutes and of rattles, of whistles, but the most important instrument, of course, is the human voice. The singing, the songs are the power of healing. The word was important. Many more things, but let me just drop those because there are parallels with our own tradition as well. And to pick up that second theme or affirmation, that of humor. Humor is a necessary part of worship. If there's anything single thing that I've learned about Native American spirituality that was largely new, that, you know, I didn't have a hunch about, this was the one. And I should, you know, have been clued into that already. The book, The Sacred, has an intriguing chapter, largely illustrative as the book is, on sacred fools and clowns. It is seemingly, they say, and my reading supports this, it is seemingly universal. The clown comes under many names, and they rattle these off, that every Native American culture traditionally has as central to their life, and particularly central to their worship, the clown figure. I put on the board the one that's common in the plains. In the Lakota language or the Dakota language, it is the Heyoka, the backwards one. And I'll say some more about these. Black Elk himself, and there's a marvelous chapter in the Black Elk Speaks that he himself is called to be, for a time being, the Heyoka. This is one who has been called by the thunder bearings, by the thunder and the lightning, and has a powerful role in the community. Very often, particularly in the plains, the backwards one is connected with thunder and storm and with rain. And several sources, but the sacred says, though the names are different and sometimes their functions different, every clown in Native American society would surely recognize the clown in the other society. Their functions, their purposes were indeed so similar. If you saw the movie Little Big Man, Dustin Hoffman plays that, there is a brief interpretation of the Cheyenne backwards one. I don't know what the title would be in Cheyenne, but it's very similar in the role to the Sioux backwards one. And they have a whole series of feats that are almost magical. And, you know, they can reach into boiling water and then pull out, you know, put their hand in that. And they learn these techniques. They are entertainers. They deal with the children. Or in the Black Elk stories, you know, those are the ones that are the humorists that are there. Let me quote something from the sacred, you know, Black Elk Speaks in that, where he has performed that role and what it means in that context. What do I begin? Yeah. He begins a short chapter. I'll say something about Heyokas and the Heyoka ceremony, which seems to be very foolish, but is really not so. Only those who have had visions of the thunder beings of the West can act as Heyokas among our people. For they have a sacred power, and they share some of this power with all the people. But they do it through funny actions. When a vision comes from the thunder beings of the West, it comes with terror like a thunderstorm. But when the storm of vision has passed, the world is greener and happier. For wherever the truth of vision comes upon the world, it is like the rain. That's a common theme among the Heyokas. The world, you see, is happier after the terror of the storm. But in the Heyoka ceremony, everything is backwards. It is planned that the people should be made to feel jolly and happy, first so that it may be easier for the power to come to them. Footnote, I don't know if they can do the bizarro world and do Saturday Night Live here, but we have our modern secular versions of this, and indeed those are similar, and their function is similar, by the way. Then he goes on. You have noticed that the truth comes into this world with two faces. One is sad with suffering, and the other laughs. But really, it is the same face, laughing or weeping. When the people are already in despair, as when he becomes a Heyoka in his own time, maybe the laughing is better for them. And when they feel too good, too happy, and are too sure of being safe, maybe the weeping face is better for them to see. And so I think that that is what the Heyoka ceremony is for, to provide that balance. When things are going well, to remind you of the suffering and the sadness. When despair overcomes you, to treat it with a great deal of humor. Interestingly, because it is in the most sacred of ceremonies, for example, the sun dance, that the most precious symbols, The dancers themselves, and the children have a role. The children come out in the sun dance. It's even true in the contemporary sun dance. And these guys who are sort of in pain and giving of their flesh, it's the children's task to ridicule them and to ridicule elements of the ceremony itself. Sometimes offensive to those of us with a Protestant mentality or Christian mentality, some of the things are even obscene, at least what the early reporters gave on that sort of thing, and they seem that way. And especially, there isn't that strong priestly-like figure in the plains, but the holy man has some of those characteristics. There is a task to, we would say, mock the priest, those who have the power to reach into the other world and to make access to these powers. They are to be ridiculed. They are to be called down because they are human too. Or the accounts indicate the backwards persons or the clowns are filled with contradictions. One term that is often translated by the language, it is the term the wise priest. He stands alongside the solemn priest. And the clown is another phrase that puts through it. He is the innocent wise one. The characteristics of the child, naivete, but naivete is gained with a great deal of wisdom. I'm reminded of the Hans Christian Andersen story of the child. And he comes in and recognizes that the emperor really doesn't have any clothes. And nobody around there has sort of, the guts to say the emperor is naked. And they all sort of pay homage to the emperor there. And the child comes through and sees, obviously, with that sense of naivety and innocence and has the courage to speak it. And the culture allows him to speak these offensive and iconoclastic things about the emperor and the leaders, and particularly the religious figures. What is the purpose of the clown and the variety of forms? These things are suggested. They're the ones who are to ask why. You take nothing for granted, and especially the things that are most sacred. You will unmask them, as modern sociologists might say. The purpose to keep all humble. It is amazing if you read the liturgies and the stories that are very humorous, it is a task to bring them down to earth. That is one of the jobs of the trickster figure, which is one of the forms of the clowns and the coyote stories that come among plains people. To reveal the arrogance, to bring them down to earth. Or as Blackout noticed in that account that I gave, it is to enable them in the time of pain and suffering to take a humorous look, a more distant look at that, and recognize that times will change, to see this in a way that is more whole. Or the most common language, and the sacred picks up that theme very strongly, is to restore balance. The primary problem with people and with the world is a matter of excesses. And wherever there is excess, it must be counterbalanced. It must be countered by its opposite. Or the very nature of spirituality or religion itself, because it is in religion that we take ourselves most seriously, that arrogance and pride and deceit flourish. And a great deal of wisdom here, particularly in those societies in which the priest is center, is at the center. To take a humorous look at that as well. And to the point with which I began, to remind us of our humanness, that we human beings with all our powers are indeed very, very weak and very, very foolish. We have many clowns at Holden. And I'm sure you've recognized one of them in particular. I knew that a long time before I came here. Of Dan Erlander. He is the genius of that. When he writes a paragraph, there's that sort of subtle twist of every sort of paragraph that he writes, that it is there. And if you go over to the Resource Center, I expected that when I got there. He has a board of just sort of these marvelous cartoons. And most of the cartoons poke fun at the most sacred things of the Christian faith. And who is the patron saint of Dan? It is Saint Francis. And the Christian tradition has said this is the figure of gaiety, that Saint Francis, more than anyone since the time of Christ, has sort of represented the role of the clown. We have at Augustana College in the last few years, and perhaps it happened many places, clown ministries that students put up and take that traditional figure of the fool and blend those elements of ridicule and of sadness to teach. And so these clown programs were profound teaching things. Indeed, there is a very rich tradition that developed especially strongly in medieval and post-medieval Christianity as Christ as the clown. I don't know if any of you remember that back in the mid-60s. It grew out of the New York World's Fair. There was a film called Parable. Did any of you ever see that?
Yeah.
I think it's still circulating around. It came and was shown there and became one of the controversial and intriguing things of that fair. And then the film circulated. I was in campus ministry at the University of Iowa at the time. And our Presbyterian pastor just got a copy. I'm going to have it for this week and anybody who share it. And we got it and brought it over to our Lutheran campus center at that time, and had not had time to advertise it very much, and so word of mouth. But that Sunday when we showed that film, and we usually had a modest sort of group there of faithful people that came around, and all of a sudden we looked out, and it was a rainy day and thunderstorm, but the rains lifted up, and I looked out just before we were going to show the film the first time, and people were coming from everywhere to see that film. There's something intriguing about that. A very short film that portrays Christ as the circus clown, and almost totally filmed in the museum in Wisconsin, Baraboo, Wisconsin, and that gives no answers but gives suggestions of the role of the clown. And somehow at that time, and I think other times, captures that sort of motif within the Christian faith. I don't know what that means. But just to cite that indeed that is a part of our own tradition. Some suggested things of learnings, and then we will share for the rest of the time. Again, to remind us that note, Jesus as that figure of the clown and of the fool is a part of our heritage. Other figures, Saint Francis in particular, have reminded us of the role of humor. We have our contemporary clowns within the Christian faith, some of the greatest teachers. Our clouds. Learnings. What about for our worship? I mentioned earlier that it seems, and many have commented, that those of us out of European or Western Christendom, particularly Protestants, have made our worship largely a matter of the ear and of the mind, and the body is not involved. Although we Lutherans have added that element of music. Ella DeLauria, whom I quoted earlier in this week, feels, but she is a biased Episcopalian perhaps at that point, but she says that the Dakota Indians responded at the time that the Christian missions came in very much to the Catholic and Episcopalian forms, because they were forms of liturgy and life that gave honor to color and to motion and these sorts of things, and they were not banned. Perhaps there's some truth into it. Have you ever been to any Indian gatherings? Most of them, and the Christian ones as well, these forms are very much prominent. And then that figure of the clown in our worship and religious life. To unmask what is most sacred and most solemn. To ask why. To see ourselves. One footnote. Maybe a couple of them, and then we will share. I mentioned Dan Erlander, and at least that's the perspective that I have had of him, and I'm sure others have too. A number of years ago, I came across a book called The Humor of Christ by Elton Trueblood, and I never been struck by Elton Trueblood as sort of a humorous sort of fellow. I've seen him and read many of his stuff, and fairly serious. He's a philosopher, a Christian philosopher, but indicated that a great deal of the teachings of Jesus in the New Testament accounts are cast with humor, if we understand the culture of the time. If we misunderstood some of these teachings, unless we understood the humorous element that was a part of them. And some of the troublesome parables also become luminous when we see that element, because Again, that humor, the very teachings of Christ himself. And we come to the scriptures with a great deal of solemnity and perhaps miss those points. You know, maybe we should laugh when Jesus said the Pharisees were so religious that they strained out the gnats. You know, every little tiny invisible sort of bug is out of their milk. But meanwhile, they have no trouble swallowing camels. You know, it's in the form of exaggeration. What are the illustrations that are there? And the other note, in my introductory course at Augustana for a number of years, I used, in dealing with the Gospel of Mark, I put alongside of it as kind of a parable, Ken Kesey's One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And if you know the book, it was a kind of a modern secular Christ figure. There's no doubt about Kesey's intention, and the book is filled with humor. And Randall Patrick McMurphy is a Christ figure, but he is also a gambling fool and a very secular and profane sort of person. But he takes on the role of giving his life for the brothers he loves. And my students have difficulty. That's one of the reasons I use it. How dare you put up that sort of a jolly and humorous figure alongside Jesus? And they have most difficulty at that point of seeing any connection, because a Christ figure, even though they might recognize that the similar roles are there, could have any element of humor, because humor is the last thing you'd associate it with Jesus. And that's probably a part of our heritage. Those things, affirmations and notes, where do you want to pick it up in terms of our understanding and our appropriation? Yeah. You said you're a clown here, so tell me.
I could be forever grateful if you could give me an answer to say to people when I say, Pastor has used me in the church service, and I've been in a lot of Christian schools for the little ones and stuff.
Yeah.
But people's eyebrows go way up when I say I am a clown in church. What answer do I give them? They say, where? I said, well, I think it goes a long ways back in the Bible, but that doesn't seem sufficient for some of them. Mm-hmm. What would be a good answer to give
you? You know, the answer to keep on doing it, I would suggest.
I am at a loss as to what we need to come up with when we ask that. So many can't understand, you know, the clown in the church. All I can say is that we want you to understand that Christians are happy people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel that's too sufficient. But.
Yeah. I mean, something about happy people. You're sort of joyous, and the threat is sort of removed, and the figure of the clown is the contradictory figure. That's one of the things here, and the figure of the clown that I think in the Christian tradition is also contradictory. You know, that, like Blackout says, when people are at ease and comfortable and joyful, you're reminded, you know, of the other side of life. And when you're in trouble, you know, you're reminded the other way, too, a sort of word of comfort.
Laughter is medicine in so many ways.
Mm-hmm.
Learning becomes easier if you can laugh. And
it disarms one. It opens one up. Yeah, go ahead.
That's right. Well, yeah. If you add laughter to so many things, they become easier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just in terms of pedagogy, I think
it takes away the heaviness. You can become more receptive.
Yeah.
The loss of that inhibition on the part of the person who is the clown. You know, you have to give up yourself and all your.
Yeah, you immerse yourself in that role. Yeah.
You a fool is somebody who just sort of gives up. Their personal inhibition and let a message come through them without their personality having to be wary of what they might
look like. I've never studied the biblical things of St. Paul because, you know, that we are fools for Christ and, you know, exactly what that means and, but that, you know, that idea comes. But that's a tradition that continues in the church of being a fool for Christ and is part of that motif of the, you know, All Fool's Day. That's more that.
Well, I wear two tears. Now, Pastor used this in his service.
Yeah.
I wear two tears, although I am a happy clown. but I have a...
Do you have the turned down mouth? Do you have the turned up mouth?
I have a turned up mouth, okay, but I wear 2 tears because I have a very close friend that is dying of cancer, and mm-hmm. those tears are for her. And like he emphasized, you can also be happy and you can be sad mm-hmm. at the same time.
Those students that have shown it to me have, you know, that their custom, they explain these conventions that are there, that often you have both of the symbols of happiness and sadness in every makeup pattern, and that's, yeah.
Gwen, I want to ask, how did you start it out? I mean, how did you think of it, or?
Well, as they said, I've always been a clown, they say, in the church, and I finally... Well, I don't know. I've always wanted to be a clown. Like I said, when my husband died 3 years ago, I thought, why not? He always encouraged it. But because I didn't sew, which I look back on now and know it's ridiculous, and I can't make all these costumes, I can't do this, I didn't do it. So then when he died 3 years ago, I thought, why not? And I'm not getting any younger, so I decided to do it. And now I find, that they're doing it, well, I guess they have been doing it back east a lot in the churches, having clowns.
Mm-hmm. Some ministries, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that.
One of the most popular services at the Washington Cathedral is the Nativity service at 4 o'clock on December 24th. The place is jammed. It's the Nativity story, but the highlight is the coming of the clown.
Really?
Yeah, they do all sorts of crazy things.
Yeah.
See, I love it. I'm happy when I really am. I really love it. I bubble over when I'm with the youngsters. Mostly, I think, with the youngsters, because they respond to me so good.
The response, well, at least my students, you know, they do the, you know, the clown ministry there, and most of that is with children, and they talk about the response, and the way of communicating with them is, you know, almost sort of magical.
There are resources. I mean, there are people who have worked up clown ministries who would be happy to come and spend, you know, some time with the congregation, because there are a lot of parallels in the life of the clown and the life of Christ. I mean, there's ridicule, there's rejection, there's resurrection. Mm-hmm. The motifs that belong to the life of the clown are the same ones that we see, although you see them differently, as you pointed out. And that film itself, if it's still around, would be a good resource. Heroin.
Yeah.
It's a superb and very moving film.
Because, you know, the theology of the cross is there, and, you know, you have to look for the resurrection, what it means in that, but I think it sort of, you know, it doesn't give the answers, but it evokes.
A large group of our high school students at church, and then there's some of their leaders, counselors, did a liturgy service, and they were all clowns, and it was just very beautifully done, very effective. They did give you a little printed form, so you could follow along for those that weren't familiar with what was happening, and it was done like mimes would do it. There was an occasional bit of music, but otherwise it was completely silent,
mm-hmm.
and you saw every part of the liturgy. And then the, I guess you'd call it the lesson part, whatever, when it came across that way, they had one part where many of them came up to these tall measuring sticks and they tried to jump, be perfect sort of thing. Mm-hmm. They couldn't measure up. Mm-hmm. And they all fell to the ground. You've probably seen that, the same one. And then they turned around these two, this one big measuring stick. And on the back was a cross. Oh, and around their necks they had this load, a couple big black circles that were their sins, obviously. And then, they were still all lying on the ground there, very distraught. One saw the cross and came up to the cross and left their sins there at the cross and just darted out of the church almost all the way out, and then turned around and realized all these people were back there and came back and went to one or to two, and then they each helped one another, and pretty soon they were all leaving.
Huh.
It was just very effective. Yeah. They took that and went for maybe 10, 12 days, whatever, and did it up and down the coast for other people.
You and then you and
I've noticed that when I was younger that the church service was very solemn, and it was almost a sad affair, and but I noticed lately that that in our church, why, it's a happy affair, and people are smiling, and if somebody does a good job of singing, we actually clap for them, which is unheard of in the old days. I think that's good, because I think that's wonderful for young people, because they can express themselves a little more fluently without having to be so solemn and have a long face. I think it should be a happy occasion.
And it's always has been up here, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Because my boy 19 years ago was up here.
Yeah.
And for 3 years, and when he'd come home and go to our church, he'd say, "Oh, Mom, you all walk up to that altar like you're taking the last mile." I said, "Well, now, wouldn't it look silly if your mother skipped up the aisle?"
Yeah.
Now I don't, but I'll pat somebody and kiss somebody or something, and it's accepted.
Yeah.
And I call our pastor about, yeah, I have a lot of respect and everything for him, but I'll call him Father John or Brother John, and he loves it, you know.
In the very midst of solemnity, and the solemnity is appropriate, but you know, that's the most important point I hear from this, that you know, you have to learn, you know, that you know, the gaiety and perhaps even the mockery there. Yeah.
Response is the key for me this whole session that because the movement, the symbols especially, I was very interested in it. It's obvious that the Native Americans do not look at symbols and contemplate them and consider and think of the symbols and how they've applied their lives. No, they respond to them.
Mm-hmm.
That's and the clown, you must respond to that. It brings it out, it makes you respond.
It's a living symbol, it's moving, it's doing, and you don't contemplate clowns. A couple notes of biblical interpretation. I guess I think, you know, we talk about worship, and those have come from the Scandinavian or North German tradition, you know, that it is so terribly serious and solemn, you know, that's just sort of overwhelming burden that is there. But I find it even strongly in the biblical interpretation that we have difficulty reading the scripture. For example, the prophets, a book like Amos, which is terribly solemn, is filled with irony. And one of the difficult jobs of teaching that in students is for people to see the irony. You know, he says one thing and he means the opposite. And it is a difficult thing because you take it at its face value and you don't get, you know, it's very devastating humor. You know, and Amos invites, you know, come out and sin brown. I mean, do it up brown, do it boldly. And that, you know, he doesn't mean invite him that, but many students will say, well, that's exactly what Amos wants. That's what's there. Or Jesus comes along, and I forget exactly where that passage of words are. He says that we came, in contrast to John the Baptist and his disciples, and we came piping, and you know, that asked you to dance, you know, and you wouldn't dance. And Jesus is seen, the critique of him, the criticism that he was a glutton and a wine bibber. I mean, he was a party man. And there must have been some basis in that in seeing him, and you know, they didn't take the solemnity of John, complaint, but also they didn't understand the gaiety with Jesus appeared in the scene.
I'm sorry, I just remembered that you had Kachina on the board.
Yeah, I didn't mention that. Yeah.
She's got one in her hand, isn't that what that is?
Oh, okay, I'll get your comment, then we'll come back to the Kachina before we, I forgot even to do that there.
When I first saw your title, Humor is Sacred and Related to Native Americans, my first impression was, oh, that's why they never smile, because it's too sacred.
Oh, yeah, I never thought of that.
I haven't had enough contact with Native Americans to actually verify that or not, but the photographs, you know, you see the chieftains and so forth are always very...
The vision of the Stoic, you know, sort of reserve the, like, Scandinavians.
So are they like us in that their ceremonies are very serious and we're all very Stoic and reserve the humor for...
Well, the ceremonies I observe and most of them are described, they're not very Stoic. You know, the Stoicism, you know, the simile sort of endurance of pain, for example, it comes alongside with the humor. Maybe that's where you talk about the Kachina. Are you familiar with the Kachina?
Not at all.
Oh. That is one of the forms of the clown, and we're familiar with the Kachina dolls. I mean, it's become an art form, like the sand paintings and so forth. But the Kachina dolls, and also especially the Kachina dancers had the role of unmasking, of taking the things that are most sacred and reveal that they're sort of mundane, that they are human. I've seen these in the Hopi country and northern Arizona, and also in some of the Pueblo societies, the Kachina dancers are there. And this is another form of the clown. Put in the midst of dealing with that which is most sacred and most solemn. They represent the powers, but also in the dance ceremonies, I understand, that they revealed at crucial moments, and this is a shocking thing for children, the traditional society, that the Kachina is one of the local villagers. And all of a sudden you realize that the powers indeed are also very human.
So like Santa Claus then?
Yeah, sort of like unmasking Santa Claus. It's very important for the unmasking of the things and the symbols that are most sacred.
But one place we stopped on the way here was the Spokane Native American Museum, and they have some really elaborate Kachina masks there. And you know, you can hardly believe the how they could have the skill to do. There's a couple of layers of this carved wood that are just massive things that they had to wear on them, and they break away one layer, either like opening a big mouth or the head opens sideways, and inside is another mask, and often an animal kind of thing, or big beaks, and so forth. It's just really fascinating, just the art that they put into it.
Yeah, and we've seen and appreciated in terms of the fantastic skills and art forms, again, like the you know, the animal forms of the Northwest or the false face societies of the Northeast. And my idea is, you know, these have similarity, and they're associated with ceremonies, and ceremonies that have much to do with unmasking, to revealing, and the role of the clown. Yeah.
Well, then, going back, how do the totem poles, how do they fit into this? You know, went up to Alaska and we saw a lot of totem poles, and it seems to me that some of those were of animals, of course, and of, I don't know if clowns were involved or not. I never thought about that.
I'm not sure of the connection with clowns and totem poles, and maybe some others. That, you know, that there is that idea of one type of animal that represents your people or your clan, and that's a very common thing. And how that is related to humor, I'm not sure if it is. But then identified, and you have in the Pacific Northwest, you know, that each great family has their thing, and that you build it. Some of the figures, you know, it seems sort of grotesque and humorous, but I don't know if that's connected with humor or not. Carol?
I'd like to describe one of our more recent experiences that involved a clown was that a group of people in South Dakota wanted to make a witness to our concern about the nuclear arms race by having an Easter sunrise service at a missile site. You know, you just drive along Interstate 90 in South Dakota and other western states, you can see these little fenced-in areas where the Minuteman missiles are buried. And we thought Easter, with the sign of resurrection, is that we wanted to symbolize we'd like to see these tombs empty too. You know? And so the group was to have a lily procession and worship service and then place the lilies as close as the authorities would allow us to the missile site. It was all very well planned in terms of working with military people and so forth like that. And we had to drive in the middle of the night in order to get to this spot at the time that sunrise came. But we had a procession, and one of the major figures in our worship was a mime clown who was wearing a cardboard missile on his back. And at the appropriate part of the service was broken, I believe, on the cross. And that was a symbol then of that, what it was for us that we had to give up the missiles. I didn't catch all the symbolism that was going on, but that was also a common or very exciting part of the peace rally in New York City last year, where there were a number of clowns type things that were in that parade. And there were some huge, you know, the heads were like this, and then maybe some garments flowing below, dancing in the streets and acting out good overpowering evil and so forth. You know, there'd be the real nasty looking fellows and then the angelic type fellows and then a dove and so forth. Just, you know, these were some of the most moving demonstrations without words, you know, of what clowns can do to help us see through the defenses that we have.
Mm-hmm. What about our own contemporary worship or life? This is a connection here that, you know, that talks about the role of the clowns to unmask, to remove pretensions, to remind you of your weakness and your humanity. In that sense, particularly those of us come from this, you know, traditions of Northern Europe, where we seem to have greater need than most at that point. Our religious figures, you know, again, I see that theme coming through, that it is the most sacred people. Indeed, they are sacred. They are in touch with the powers, with reality. And these are the ones which the culture encourages you to mimic, to mock. And very often it is children that play the role of mimicking the most sacred persons. Somehow I don't think we're ready for that. Or simply the fact that our worship is so solemn, there's some ways in which we can put that counterbalance there, or the interpretation of scripture or tradition. Or Carol is suggesting one of the real forms of worship in our society are the gods of metal, that which we have created with human hands that we looked upon us to protect us, and that to which we sacrifice. And all of a sudden to see that from the perspective, to see how foolish our worship is. We're moving into sacred ground.
In one of the World's Fairs out in New York, Vern Reiki, who is at the University of Glasgow, used to be president of the Fulton Board, was responsible for the booth on religion. And they had the clown movie, and so they went around all over, but they had a terrible amount, you know, huge amount of criticism.
What sort of criticism came to that? Because,
right, that, you know, it should have been sacred, and it was all clown.
The very end, because it was the clown.
Right.
Yeah. That was it, because you had that sort of reaction, because I was aware of that, and among college students at that time, this was in the late 60s, they were fascinated. And a lot of students in America came, and we had to show it several times, and they talked about that, and but somehow it sort of spoke to them, and they were intrigued by it, that image. And it has a way of breaking through.
Do you know anything about the Pacific Indians?
About what?
Pacific Indians along our coast in Washington?
Relatively little. I'm just secondhand things.
But. Well, I've had an opportunity to study a lot of it. And on our totem poles, you'll find a bear.
Mm-hmm.
He was created for humor, to make God laugh. You find a coyote. That was your personal laughter.
That's a common figure, yeah.
Yeah, that was your personal laughter. He was humor.
Yeah.
The beaver was busy. Mm-hmm. The fish was everlasting food.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And but your totem pole was your life. And it started at the top, and I never knew how they carved them, because the top was a top hat, or some of them had eagles.
That had the other great beak.
Yeah, the great beak, the what was the bird, the thunderbird?
Thunderbird, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, but that's how you started, and the bottom was the end of your life. Mm-hmm. And I said, how can you start at the top and go down to the bottom? But that isn't how they carve them. They carve them this way.
Comes from the bottom up.
Mm-hmm. And you'll find a lot of those that have animals standing with a person underneath of them. And they have chosen these to be their personal guardian. And some of them are bears.
Yeah.
And so they are a cheerful person.
That's interesting with the bear, because in Plains culture, the bear is almost always associated with healing.
Yes,
and the humor that I'm aware of, and the Plains, the creature that is almost always associated here with is the coyote, or the coyote.
Okay.
And some cultures, the spider figure is the figure of humor. It's interesting because you have parallel stories among Plains people as you have in Africa.
Oh.
And the humorous devil, so to speak, or the one that sort of messes things up in the folk stories of the Plains people is Iktomi. And that also means not only clown, and it's another type of clown, but it is also the spider is the word for that, and you all of a sudden you go into African cultures. I don't know which ones now that the figure, the the very parallel role. So you have creatures that that fill these roles, and again and again you have these stories that are very humorous, and they're probably much more humorous in the context. They're intended to instruct children and to give them a kind of wisdom or maturity, to move beyond naivete, to make them a bit wiser.
We have a man who's called Chief Aluska that lives at Ariel Dam, and he has storytelling time, mm-hmm. and he does this for different youth organizations. I belong to the campfire organization, and he's done it for years, and he has a longhouse and everything. He explains the ceremonial purpose of each thing, and the house is set up on four totem poles, and why the totem poles are there, the doorway is a totem pole, and why you enter through crawling through it.
Mm.
And it's very, you enter because you have to be humbled.
Yeah, that's the motif.
Uh-huh. And you literally crawl on your hands and knees to get in. Mm-hmm. And he's a big man, weighing over 250 pounds and tall, and he has to struggle to get in. And he says he is really humbled because he said, I'm the one telling the story. It makes me realize that I'm just a voice. And he dresses in all the regalia that he has as a chief and explains everything he has on. The reason for it. And he has one necklace that has a bell. And he says, that's to remind me I'm to be humorous.
In that idea of reminding.
Uh-huh.
You remind me of Chow.
Yeah. I have friends who that are sort of natural clowns. I don't know whether they've gained that through their genes or their environment. Carol knows this when the guy named Sheldon Tofsenkar that I teach at the seminary, and used to be a colleague of mine of Augustana, and he's one of these fellows that, everything he taught was that sort of a very subtle kinds of humor. And he could, at the most solemn occasions, he would just sort of give the phrase or the word that would sort of enlighten it up and all of a sudden inciting. And he's one that commented on the Ken Kesey story that said he thought that was a great bit of literature because it was precisely when it was most serious, it is most humorous, and the most humorous, it is most serious. And it is a marvelous way of teaching. And he embodied that, that nobody could imitate this guy. On that, he got the most serious and profound points to the device of levity. And it indeed is offensive to many of our students, the way he did that, even though he did it very gently. And that's a gift. And I think we need the clowns within our society. Any other words? Go in peace and make fun.